PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From WNYC in New York and Public Radio International, I'm Kurt Anderson. Take it from John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Being all alone can be a drag. For the most popular pop band ever, the Beatles could record some really bleak stuff. All the lonely people, where do they all come from? Eleanor Rigby is a hard look at the lives of two people who work in a church and have nobody to come home to. And there's something strangely unsympathetic about the song. Paul's line, "Where do they all belong?" hints that maybe lonely people could be sent somewhere where we don't have to worry about them. But being by yourself doesn't have to be a curse. When this old world starts getting me down, and people just a few years before Eleanor Rigby, the Drifters had a top 10 hit about the pleasures of putting everybody else at a distance. I climb way up to the top of the stairs, and all my cares just drift right into space. Up on the Roof sees modern life and its crowds as a rat race from which we all need to escape, at least for a little while. Today in Studio 360, we are talking about being alone, its creative pleasures, and its hazards. Joining me is the writer Jonathan Lethem. He got big acclaim a few years ago for his novel Motherless Brooklyn, and his most recent novel is called The Fortress of Solitude, about a boy growing up as almost the only white kid on his block in 1970s Brooklyn. He's got a brand new collection of essays out right now. And Jonathan Lethem, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
Now, you called your most recent novel The Fortress of Solitude after Superman's hideout up near the North Pole.
Yeah.
How come?
Well, I always was sort of fascinated and amused by the idea of the Fortress of Solitude because here's Superman, who's the sort of the most popular guy in the world, and he needs this place up in the Arctic to go and sort of lick his wounds and brood and walk the hallways of this giant empty fortress and talk to himself, which is what he does up there. And the fact that even Superman kind of needed to sulk a lot and needed to have this special place to go and do it struck me as revealing of something incredibly petulant and I guess self-pitying in the image of the superhero and of course the image of the teenager who adores a superhero.
Well, that's it, isn't it? And as you were just speaking, I realized that as a kid, as a DC Comics kid, as a Superman lover, I love the Fortress of Solitude episodes. And I guess that, again, speaks to the kind of pre-adolescent and adolescent sensibility that goes for both of those.
Yeah. Well, spins. You know, Superman even has a collection of statues of his friends in the Fortress of Solitude. So he's got a sort of a statue of Lois Lane and a statue of Jimmy Olsen, and he goes and he kind of gazes at them and talks to them as though that's better than being with, you know, the real Jimmy Olsen, who's down in Metropolis, you know, anytime Superman would care to spend time with him.
Now, your novel, Fortress of Solitude, seems autobiographical. How was your life as a boy like or different than the hero, your hero Dylan's?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you asked that question in this framework of solitude, because the biggest differences across the board are that I increased the isolation of the character. You know, he's a single son of being raised by a single father. I was actually, you know, I grew up in a family with siblings, and I had a mom much later into my childhood than the main character of the book. So I've reduced his options for contact.
I would love it if you'd read a little bit of The Fortress of Solitude for us.
Sure. Here goes. The week after Halloween had a quality both hungover and ominous. The light pitched. The sky smashed against the rooftops. November. "Go deep," Henry commanded. Now he wagged a football, the latest enticement. Four kids were like yo-yos strung to his hand, running to jump in a cluster when he finally spiraled the football half the length of the block. No matter what happened, whichever hands the ball came down in or eluded, Henry's expression was sour. There was something inelegant or compromised in the ball's descent from the air where he'd placed it. Dylan Ebdus waited on Henry's stoop in a bubble of silence, seeing he made six, wondering if they'd call him into the street to even the sides for a game. He detected in himself a certain translucency today, a talent for being ignored. Rachel had flushed him from a four-day hide in his room, from a retrenchment into the secret power of his books and pencils, into the mysteries of eavesdropping on Abraham's footfalls and Rachel's clangor on the telephone, into the dreary conundrums of the Etch-a-Sketch and the Spirograph. And something in his conjured solitude had followed him out onto the street, then reversed itself to drape all over him anywhere he sat still. Gaze long enough into Dean Street, and Dean Street will gaze into you.
That's Jonathan Lethem reading from his novel, The Fortress of Solitude, which is our subject today in Studio 360, Solitude. As you say, Dylan lost his mother as a, I think, 10-year-old in your book. You lost your mother much later. Did that, however, become a kind of the transformative event of your young adulthood?
Well, you know, I've written about loss over and over again. My first few novels all center around some enormous missing piece, whether it's language or you know, there's a kind of amnesiac loss of memory that's a condition that the characters suffer. And as I worked on my fourth and fifth novels, I realized I was moving closer and closer to writing about a personal condition of losing a parent. But I'm not sorry in a way that I circled around that main subject for so long, because I think what matters to me about my own loss, paradoxically, is that it's connected to universal feelings of, you know, disconnection or suffering, and that in a funny way, I was handed this enormous subject matter.
Uh-huh.
My mother died of cancer slowly while I was turning 11, 12, 13, and 14 when she finally died, same year I began high school. But in some way, I think experiencing that loss only increased a pre-existing feeling for a condition of having lost something. Growing up in New York in the 1970s, I was very sensitive to the feeling that the world itself had suffered some kind of fundamental displacement or loss. New York City itself seemed like a kind of dystopian city. My parents, who were radicals, had grown up protesting in the civil rights era and then protesting the Vietnam War. And even though both of those battles had been won in some sense, there was something in the mid-70s that felt very much like a kind of loss of possibilities mm-hmm. for the counterculture. And I was so sensitive to this idea that great things fell apart that I think when my own family fell apart because of my mother's illness and then death, it seemed to me only the natural course of things.
Jonathan Lethem is my guest today, and we're talking about being alone. Our first story is about a musician named Andrew Bird, whose music I absolutely adored when I first heard it. And from the sweet, lonely sound of it, I was not surprised to learn that he plays every instrument himself, not just on his records, but live on stage, where he uses digital loops off a computer to play all the parts of his songs. What's more, I found out a few years ago, Bird created his own fortress of solitude. He moved out of Chicago to a farm and isolated there from other musicians, even from music on the radio. He found his own music developing in ways he didn't expect.
The barn is situated on 350 acres of rolling hills and limestone cliffs and springs and forests. It's really close to the Mississippi River, so it's kind of where the glaciers sort of mist. And there's corn and soybeans and chickens. It's crazy. When I moved out there, I drove out there in a snowstorm in late February, and there was no one out there. And the barn wasn't quite finished, and I was loading in all my stuff, and I went out to the chicken shack, And the sun had just gone down. It was kind of like that purplish sky, and it was snowing. And there was a peacock sitting on the back of my grandpa's 73 Chevy pickup truck. And I've never seen a peacock again since I've been there. It was a weird way to start this whole, like, kind of three-year antisocial adventure. I felt like I needed a place to get away and to work. What it ended up being is, like, this sort of self-imposed vacuum. Like, let's see what happens when I stop listening to records, I move out into the middle of nowhere, and have this space to experiment and let melodic ideas come out of wherever they come out of. I feel like the melodies and the arrangements, since I've been out there, and reflecting the landscape too, just sort of opened up. When I spend too much time at the barn, the creative process slows down, and I'm writing less songs, but I'm getting deeper in those songs. But I'm aware of, like, that things have kind of been grinding to a slower pace since I've been out there just in my own head. I think what I'm able to create by myself is somehow more interesting than what I could do with the band right now. I both have this, like, isolation to work and experiment, but I also go straight from that experimentation and working with myself straight to a stage now with the solo show. Whereas before I'd have to, you know, schedule rehearsals with my band and kind of go through this negotiation of sort of letting go of your songs. Really who I interact with now instead of a band is the audience. A lot of times I'll play a half-finished song for the audience and, like, as if to ask them what they think, you know. That's replaced my band, really. I think the lyrics have gotten a lot more like internal conversations. Like Lull, for instance, became like the theme about someone who's trying to convince themselves that it's cool to be alone. Being alone can be quite romantic, like Jacques Cousteau, Underneath the Atlantic.
Being alone, it can be quite romantic, like Jacques Cousteau, Underneath the Atlantic, a fantastic.
And then then there's a completely ridiculous line, which is embarrassing and self-conscious, but became so true. I'm rambling on rather self-consciously, stirring these condiments into my tea, and I think I'm so lame, I bet I think this song is about me. Don't I?
I'm so lame that I think this song is about me. Don't I? I'm in a low.
Ultimately, when I was out there, I had to convince myself that being alone, though sometimes necessary, really, you can convince yourself that it's romantic if that makes you feel better. It was this sort of extreme experiment, and it was really cool, and all this cool stuff came out of it. But, you know, in many cultures, moving out and being isolated and from everyone else is like a fate worse than death, you know? And there I was out there just kind of obsessing over that idea. Like, what? Why am I out here? What drove me to live in a barn by myself in the middle of nowhere? So all the while, I knew that there was going to come a time when I had to come back and re-engage and play with musicians again, and that time has finally come. So
Andrew Bird is on tour right now with just one other musician, a drummer. You can hear some more of his music at studio360.org. Jonathan Menjivar produced our story, and I am talking today with Jonathan Lethem, the novelist, about the pleasures and challenges of being alone. Jonathan, you have been a music critic, and I know you've written about your intense musical enthusiasms over the years. What do you think of Andrew Bird's music?
Well, I like the hints I was hearing there. I'm not familiar with his work, but one of my fascinations, you know, loving both the rhythm and blues and soul and rock and roll, is the whole history of people wanting to go solo, being in bands and having the sort of community that structures their work, and then, you know, whether it's to run away to a barn or not, wanting to be seen as a solo entity, you know. And this is another form of tension for the artist between community and solitude.
But what about artists, musical artists, who really from the get-go are leading in that I'll do it all myself direction? I know Brian Eno was a big hero of yours, or I think somebody like Prince, who seems from the start to be about doing it all themselves. Is that an appealing kind of artist to you, as opposed to
think it's thrilling when you realize that someone actually can make all the sounds of the band in the studio. I mean, Stevie Wonder did it too, a couple of his best records. You know, you look at the credits and you realize he's even playing drums and synthesizer, and then it's a big deal if someone sits in. You know, there's an album where every instrument is played by Stevie Wonder for 9 tracks, and then on the 10th track Jeff Beck plays guitar, and it's like his solitude has been pierced. But you know, that conforms to the other image that people celebrate, is the image of the genius. You know, it's often quite disorienting. For instance, if you look at the acknowledgments page of a novel and you realize that this artist who you've valorized as this sort of heroic character off in the wilderness, you know, inventing everything by themselves, in fact had a research assistant, you kind of don't want the hero to need anyone's help.
Jonathan Lethem is my guest today, and we're talking about solitude. In a minute, we'll hear someone coming to terms with his artist father, who really wants to be left alone.
I don't care what other people think about me, because it's not important.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
My name is secluded. We live in a house the size of a matchbox. Roaches live with us wall to wall.
Studio 360 is brought to you in part by The Economist, featuring weekly book reviews and global arts coverage on newsstands and on the web at economist.com/books.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. That song is Unopened Letter to the World by the Ataris, and it's about Emily Dickinson. Probably no writer ever spent more time by herself. When she was in her 20s, Dickinson stopped going out and socializing, and by middle age, she hardly ever left the family home. And even there, no one apparently knew that upstairs, one of America's greatest poets was at work.
The loneliness one dare not sound, and would as soon surmise as in its grave go plumbing to ascertain the size. The loneliness whose worst alarm is lest itself should see, and perish from before itself for just a scrutiny. The horror not to be surveyed, but skirted in the dark, with consciousness suspended and being under lock. I fear me this is loneliness, the maker of the soul, its caverns and its corridors illuminate or seal.
That's Emily Dickinson. Jonathan Lethem, what do you think of the idea that she puts out there that loneliness is the maker of the soul?
Well, I guess I'm instinctively allied with that. Language is our bridge, you know, and she was incredibly eloquent even without having a listener or having an audience in mind. She was making a version of herself that would matter to an enormous number of people. And you know, it's easy to read Dickinson's poems and feel that at that moment, as you're reading them, that you know her better and perhaps she knows you better than many, if not all, of your own individual, you know, intimate relationships. Your memories of human contact can seem pretty poor compared to the scalpel that she brings to you.
There is something that we continually do, and certainly in the case of Emily Dickinson, which is to romanticize a kind of extreme solitude. And if I can play devil's advocate a little bit, it sometimes strikes me as the kind of perpetual adolescent in us all, since in adolescence we are so often full of a kind of doomed romantic sense of our own isolation. How does one separate the sort of unseemly adolescent, you know, idealization of, oh, I'm a lonely artist in the world, and something more enduring and substantial and good about solitude?
It is very easy to romanticize solitude. I think every human life is a constant negotiation between those poles, and finding a way to, for instance, live inside a family and still grant yourself the solitude that you need, you know, in a way that isn't acting out or self-pitying, but has a kind of grace to it, is probably one of the primary tasks of growing up.
Do you find sitting in a room for 4 or 5 or 7 hours a day lonely or not at all?
Well, I've come to thrive on it, but it's a not a natural way to spend time. I really come to accept the idea that human beings are social creatures, and I think I had to habituate, as badly as I wanted to become a writer and as much as I idealized that state of solitude, it was very hard for me to tolerate early on.
Uh-huh.
I'd begin and I'd write a sentence or two almost the moment anything I wrote confused or excited or pleased me too much, I'd sort of explode from the room. I'd go looking for someone to make contact with. And I had to really learn to relax and trust that silence and that sense of waiting. You know, the difficult thing about writing isn't really the moments when your hands are moving on the keyboard. It's the moments between. And of course, I connect this feeling of learning to enjoy the solitude and the silence with the pleasure I always took in reading. And that's one of the simplest reasons I think no one who isn't a kind of voracious reader at some point in their life, an obsessed reader, has a very good chance of becoming a writer, not just because of the things you don't learn, but because the temperament of reading is the one that points toward this activity of sitting alone, in a way reading your own migrating thoughts.
Being the first reader of the book.
Right.
It's strange, isn't it, that, I mean, more than any other of the arts, I think, writing, literature, is both created in solitude and then enjoyed in solitude.
Well, for me, that's what makes it such an essential and irreplaceable medium. And I'm never worried when people speak of the displacement of novel writing by film or whatever else they're proposing is about to displace it, because I think there's a kind of extensiveness of the intimacy as a reader meets a book and meets the writer's mind and sits alone, you know, tracking sentence after sentence. It's a kind of intimacy that's so much more pronounced and so much more extended and sustained and deep that there's something in that medium that can't be captured anywhere else.
Our next story is about an artist, a different kind of artist named Bob Paul, who would rather keep everybody in the world at arm's length and has no need for any form of public social interaction as far as he can see it. His son, Richard Paul, thinks that solitude, like his father's, can be like an addictive drug. The more he gets, the less he seems to be able to cope without it.
What do you say about this guy, my father? An accomplished graphic artist, successful enough to have put three kids through college, a man who no one trained.
I taught myself how to do it.
A man whose art helped sell the NBA and Canadian lottery tickets, and who paints watercolors so vivid you'd swear you're looking at a photograph. A man whose self-regard and professional success have created such a monumental self-confidence that he doesn't feel he has to care what his clients think. He's so good, he knows they'll be back.
You want to hear me talk to some of these clients. They're hysterical because nobody would dare talk to them that way. You know, I tell them things like, what are you wasting my time for?
Say that to a client.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. More often than not, I laugh at these guys right to their face. And sometimes they respect that.
And what happens when they don't?
When they don't, you find another client.
But despite all this faith in his talent, when it comes to his art, my dad is surprisingly level-headed about what he can accomplish.
Do you consider yourself an artist?
I'm a schmearer. An artist is somebody who can take a blank canvas, take something out of his head, and paint it. I paint things that I like. But I'm not passionate. I mean, my idol was Vincent van Gogh, and that's a painter. I look at Renoir, and he worked alone, too. Most of these guys did.
I hope you caught that last part, because it's a key thing to say about my dad. He is a man who works alone.
I don't care what other people think about me, because it's not important. And if they don't get it, like you don't get it about who I am, then, you know, I'm sorry you don't get it, but it's not interfering in my life anyway.
What if nobody gets it? Then where are you?
Who cares? It's out of my hands.
But see, you say that what you, but you said you...
Whose interview is this? Is this your interview or mine? See, you got that look on your face. You're starting already.
My dad has always had two dreams, and for most of his life, he's been living them out. He always wanted to work in advertising, and he always wanted to do things his way.
Why? Don't know why. Probably because I was an only child. Blah, blah, blah. Why did I want to work alone? I don't know.
Whatever the reason, he never quite fit in at his first job at a small ad agency.
No matter what I did, their attitude was they knew more than I did. You know, in those days, I was a lot younger. I would say, well, why don't we try this? No, we can't do that. What do you guys think? Oh, boy. And I got so sick and tired of that I decided, you know, I had to be on my own.
Since then, starting in the attic of the house I first grew up in, he has worked by himself with no input from anyone.
Do you see any downsides to working the way that you've worked all these years?
Sometimes my work turns out for the moment to be more important than my family around me. And some of my family members are not willing to accept that.
But if my dad was absorbed in his work, he wasn't exactly ignoring us. In fact, he was teaching us lessons all the time.
In our house, advice wasn't just offered. It was more like a hose was stuck in your ear and someone turned on the advice spigot. No, I received lessons from my father and I learned them all too well. It's why, for years, I had no trouble expressing my opinion.
Virtually everybody at a top echelon in business is stupid.
But why I had such a hard time expressing any positive emotions.
You know, it's like people say, I love you. I love you. And then you say, okay, you love me. What else you got?
And why I grew up utterly confident that whatever I was doing was the right thing.
If they don't like your work, fine. They don't like me. I don't care about that either.
I learned from him all the things that made me who I am today. I can't tell you the number of times I've almost been fired, the hours I spent learning anger management. Today, I work alone.
Are we going to discuss your childhood or my career? I don't understand this.
Though, unlike him, I don't like it. When I see my dad these days, which isn't often, we always seem to have the same fight.
Why is that?
I know why. But
why?
I know why.
Why?
You have no patience.
Worst one we ever had. I was working for a university, and he was all over me. What are you working for someone else for? I told him I did it because it makes me happy. To which he said, ah, there's more to life than happiness. See, for my dad, independence trumps everything else. Even having other people appreciate what you do. I asked him about his watercolors. They are so good, people used to buy them right off the wall of a fancy restaurant in Connecticut until he stopped letting them.
It becomes a hassle. I don't know what to charge for them because I really, really enjoy them.
So today, he's the only one that gets to see them. They line the walls of his houses in Connecticut and Vermont, his office, even his garage. But believe it or not, they bring him no satisfaction. I know because I asked him if his paintings or anything he's done artistically makes him feel satisfied creatively.
I don't know. I can't answer a question like that.
Wait a minute. What about that painting of the old barn with the glorious, angry sky that's so real you can almost smell the rot and feel the humidity and the danger? Or the one of Mom looking into a window that's so lifelike I literally had to walk right up to it and look at the brush strokes to realize it wasn't a photograph? What do you mean there's nothing that stands out?
It's never really been that important. That's something you have to understand.
What has it been?
Trying to create the most successful thing for yourself.
You're trying to create the most creative thing for yourself? It's not important?
You don't understand. You're interviewing me. My life is based on what I'm working on now. That's hard for you to understand. But when you work by yourself, that's a rationale that you evolve and develop.
My father has given me so many things. I have his eye and his business acumen. He gave me tenacity and he taught me the value of a dollar. And while I do value my independence, I've learned one more lesson from my father. If you go through life pleasing yourself without thinking of others, in the end, you risk living with the empty feeling that really, you've pleased no one at all. For Studio 360, I'm Richard Paul.
A child arrived just the other day. He came to the world in the usual way, but there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away, and he was talking for I knew it, and as he grew, he'd say, I'm gonna be like you, Dad, you know I'm gonna be like you.
You can see some of Bob Paul's watercolors at studio360.org. The novelist Jonathan Lethem is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we're talking about being alone in various senses. It was amazing to me, I don't know about you, to have such an intimate look inside this sad and funny relationship between father and son.
Yeah, it was quite a gift to be let into those conversations. And Bob's directness is to be envied.
Also, where I really found it bordering on the almost strange is the fact that he gets no pleasure out of having other people even look at or buy or admire his work.
Yeah, it's fascinating. But I also think that he's maybe typical of the person who made a choice to do commercial art or advertising at some point, mm-hmm. who still remembers a time when they might have tried to be Van Gogh and isn't kidding himself.
That seems like a fair take. The fact that he is eschewing ambition altogether, not showing and not selling his work, is part of that kind of lifelong demural, I guess.
It strikes me as a kind of honesty about which kind of artist he chose to be. And what makes him so fascinating, I don't want to presume because he really is a conundrum, but in a way he's combined the mercilessness and the kind of indomitable selfishness of a great artistic talent,
yes.
The kind of willfulness that you associate with
Picasso or something.
Exactly, yeah. With a Picasso, with this very rigorous humbleness. He's not making any claims, actually, and he's not interested in any pretense that he's accomplished anything that a genius might.
Your father was an artist, a visual artist. Did watching him as you grew up teach you anything about working by yourself happily?
Sure. I mean, I had such a huge head start when I talked to other writers and artists. You know, making yourself into a writer, deciding that it's okay to spend your days that way, that it's not some esoteric or impossible kind of stance in life, is very difficult for people. But I had this enormous head start because I had the example of my father right at hand. He had a very healthy, still has a very healthy studio practice. He loves to work. He's very patient with himself. He's very forgiving. He's in the studio a lot of his time. You know, he makes it a comfortable, inviting place. You know, it's not an ascetic or monk-like place. It's more a part of, you know, normal human commerce. There's coming and going. He invites you in. He has books to read. He's a very natural artist in the sense of the relationship to the activity is very natural.
How do you feel yourself as a writer, as an artist, in relation to Bob Paul's kind of absolute defiance of what the world thinks? That there's nobody to please but yourself. It doesn't matter if people don't get it. It doesn't matter if people don't like it. I mean, that's a matter of balance, I would expect, in any artist's career of listening to your own muse but not going off some deep end.
Yeah. What he said that I related to instantly was that there's no satisfaction except in the work at hand, that it's very hard to rest on your laurels with any pleasure at all. But I've never been a writer who kept a journal because I'm not very interested in writing that isn't meant somehow to communicate, that isn't part of a possible conversation with a reader.
So even as you're writing, there is a sense in your head that you're writing for somebody. So I guess that mitigates the ultimate sense of solitude in the act of writing.
Sure. Well, you're communing with your possible readers. Often you have one or two particularly wonderful targets in mind, someone you want to impress, whether you know they'll read the book or not. You know, when I wrote The Fortress of Solitude, I spent half the time thinking, this is meant to knock Philip Roth's socks off. And I have no idea whether I've ever had the luck of being read by Philip Roth. And it doesn't matter. Thinking of him possibly reading me was part of how I got to where I needed to be in writing that book. But you also are communing with your characters. And the other antidote to the loneliness of writing fiction is you're with these people that if you're doing a good job, they've got a kind of uncanny interest in you. They they read you back. They want to please you. They want to annoy you. They want to get your attention. And you know, one of the things I sometimes feel guilty about is just how much fun I'm having communicating with these imaginary presences.
Jonathan Lethem is my guest today. Coming up, one man alone on a stage spilling his heart out from an almost comfortable distance.
I'd feel sorry for me if I were you. I don't know, really.
James Urbaniak and playwright Will Eno with the off-Broadway hit Tom Paine. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Loneliness gone bothering around my house. Loneliness gone bothering. Loneliness gone bothering. Loneliness gone bothering around my house. Loneliness.
Studio 360 is brought to you in part by Nonesuch Records, now featuring the soundtrack to The Chorus, a French tale about the transformative power of music, a Miramax release in theaters now. The Chorus soundtrack is available at tower.com/nonesuch. And by Hofstra University, continuing its Great Writers, Great Reading series, where some of America's most eminent writers read from their own works. More details at hofstra.edu.
Loneliness has followed me my whole life, everywhere. Bars and cars, sidewalks, stores, everywhere. There's no escape. I'm God's lonely man.
Robert De Niro as Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver, a great cautionary tale about spending too much time by yourself. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and the novelist Jonathan Lethem is my guest today. We're talking about being alone in music and fiction and film and on the stage. One of the most exciting new plays I've seen in a long time features a single man on a minimal set just talking. It's called Tom Paine. It's by a playwright named Will Eno, and this Tom Paine isn't any relation to the 18th century revolutionary, although the truth is we can't really tell much for sure about this guy on the stage. He's constantly revising his opinions and his portrayal of himself. But Tom is a witty guy, and his morbid humor and quirky charm keep us with him as he explores some of the darker and lonelier corners of the soul. Will Eno, who wrote Tom Paine, and James Urbaniak, the actor who inhabits the role, both join me here in Studio 360. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Now, before we talk, I would like you, James, to give our listeners a sense of the play, if you would. If you could start out with a bit of the performance as
sure.
Tom Paine.
I'm looking out at the audience, and I say, what a nice crowd. I see no difference, really, in a world filled with difference, sickening, disheartening difference. I see none between the you and the me. You all seem so wonderful, and I seem so wonderful, and so I make no distinction. I see no separation, no unbridgeable distance between us, wonderful us, or none worth remarking, since the thought of you disgusts me so much. The thought of you doesn't disgust me that much. In fact, you're all so wonderful, I'd like to take you home. Leave you there and then go somewhere else. No, seriously, the truth? I don't care either way. That's not true. I do care. Either way. I'm the type of person you might not hear from for some time, but then suddenly one day, bang, you'd never hear from me again. We're all roughly this way, yes? Roughly?
Very nicely done. James, you begin as this kind of charming master of ceremonies character, and that kind of self-confident facade begins showing cracks and then some. Even though he's playing one character, various sides of a persona from strong to weak to pathetic to charming come out in the course of the hour.
It's a beautifully written and wonderfully structured play. And actually, although at first glance it appears to be, the character seems to be rather confusing, he loses his place, he appears to be a man having a breakdown. Through the course of the evening, especially as an actor especially, but I think for the audience as well, one realizes it's actually a rather traditionally structured play. at the end, he sort of brushes himself off and he's a different person than he was at the beginning. The character appears to be sort of lost in a kind of random state, but the writing is far from random. It's actually very precise and really quite traditionally structured, I think, in a way.
Does it spoil you, do you think, doing ensemble pieces?
Well, I think it spoils me for the future of my acting career. I think, you know, when you work on something that you're really proud of and the material is so exciting.
And the New York Times says this is the greatest play of the decade.
Those experiences are few and far between in show business.
Will, do you find that your temperament as a person who is willing to spend hours and hours a day alone in a room making things up and writing lines suits what you do, or would you rather be out actually with actors putting the play up?
I like being alone and writing, and I've sort of lucked out in that way, I think. I just had read something, Howard Barker, the English dramatist, and he wrote a great little bit about why it happens in the dark, why do plays happen in the dark, and it's sort of a revision of what I think what we most tend to believe, which is that we're all together. When we turn off the lights, we're all this community sitting together and united in the darkness. But his point was that, in fact, we are all sitting separately, suffering alone in the darkness. And it is something that I tried to enable, in a way, with this play, is just to help people feel alone. It sounds sort of crazy, but I would hope that an audience member might feel one's difference, feel one's separation, if not loneliness, if not solitude, but at least just the physical separation from people.
Do you wish that you had James's ability as a performer to be able to just to write the words and get up there and do it yourself and do it all?
I guess I do wish that, but I don't have that, so I'm happy to...
The next best thing is having this guy who does it really well.
It's very nice. I'd said somewhere before once, I sort of feel like the shyer, pimplier kid in high school who keeps saying to his braver, more outgoing buddy, hey, go over and do that. Go say this to that guy and go push him down the stairs and trip that guy. And it's a very nice feeling to sit. I watch from up in the booth there, and it's a sort of sneaky feeling to be having put this in motion.
Trust me, there are people out there who don't love you, who don't love you enough to spit on your little hopes, so as to leave you all alone, respectfully and truly alone with your larger ones, your larger hopes, which are what? Sir, care to share your larger hopes with us? No? That's fine, I understand. Don't want to jinx anything, or have nothing to jinx, or can't feel hope, or don't like sharing. Oh, the varieties of experience. Feel free to feel anything. Religious ecstasy, anarchy, shivery, physical things, nothing, blood, your neighbor, that stranger you married. What possibilities we all have here. Ways and means to live and die. Cancer, for example, or depression. Political intrigue, anxiety, insecurity, holes in your knowledge, spots on your lungs, total oblivion. More, financial crisis. Outer space, inner peace, shame, lust, war, me, hate, you, hate, words, love, nothing, more, migraine, you, God, the things you may be feeling, the list goes on. Then the list ends.
James Urbaniak, Will Eno, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Will Eno's play, Tom Paine, starring James Urbaniak, is running through the summer at the DR2 Theater in New York City. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and Jonathan Lethem is here with me today. We're talking about solitude. Jonathan, have you happened to have seen Tom Paine yet?
I haven't. I'm dying to, and that those glimpses make me even more eager. And I'm very compelled by his description of the darkness in the theater. I think about that not just as a playgoer, but as a filmgoer, that there's this very interesting tension between the collective space of an audience and the kind of skull of a darkened movie theater, which is like the interior dream space for each individual watcher. It's a very selfless place to be, and then it can be very suddenly quite intimate and personal.
The book you're working on now is a comic novel, and I'm wondering how you think about the reader's experience for that, because it's very different sitting alone reading a funny book than sitting in a theater full of people, all of whom are laughing at the same scene.
Well, what I relish in funny novels, and a lot of my favorite novels are funny, it may not be the only thing that they're doing, but is a kind of humor that can't be conveyed easily. It, you wish in the middle of a funny scene to turn to your friend or loved one and say, listen to this, and then you try to read them the line, but it's so dependent on so much context that you can't reproduce the situation. That, to me, is what it is to be funny in a novel, whereas there were lines in that Will Eno play that are so epigraphically funny you could almost imagine, you know, putting them on a T-shirt, which is to take nothing away from the accomplishment of the play. But you've also got me thinking about what it is to stand in front of an audience. It's almost irresistible not to read the funniest parts of whatever you've written because you want to hear something coming back from the audience. You want to feel that you've moved them or activated them in some way. And this question of whether or not they're going to laugh is so vital. And it's to me, as a public reader, it's usually decided in the first few sentences whether or not they're going to sit there soberly, no matter how uproarious you think you're being, or whether there'll be something infectious. And that's that social laughter.
Do you like reading? Do you like the performance aspect of this usually private art?
I've come to like it. I'm not a particularly shy person. And so though I treasure the solitude that's the majority of my work, I kind of like its antidote too. I like the tonic of going out and very briefly trying to make it play in front of a crowd and feel the presence of my audience.
Jonathan Leatham, thanks very much for joining us today in Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt.
Jonathan Leatham is the author of The Disappointment Artist, The Fortress of Solitude, and Motherless Brooklyn, among other books. You can find out more about him at studio360.org. If you find yourself spending a great deal of time on your own, let's say you're trying to write a novel, and staring at the walls for long stretches of time, it might help if those walls had something more than just a coat of white paint. Today in Design for the Real World, design curator Susan Yelovich tells us why we don't appreciate wallpaper as much as we ought to.
Back in the 16th century, when paper became a little less expensive, Europeans started pasting it on their walls as a mark of prestige or decoration. The big boom begins seriously in the 18th century and then gets completely accelerated in the 19th century with machine-printed papers. So you go from stenciled papers to block-printed papers to roller-printed papers to machine-printed papers. It also actually turns in on itself from becoming an expensive commodity. It's a cheap way to get architectural detail. If you couldn't afford carved molding in your house, you could have a wallpaper with faux patterns on it. Wallpaper becomes the middle class or the poor man's architecture. My dad was the son of a builder and grew up in a family where purely plastered walls were just prized, and you would never paint a wall that wasn't plastered properly. You would wallpaper it. So when we moved into our suburban house in New Jersey, we wallpapered every room because the walls were inferior. But it was actually one of the few choices you got to make as a kid. Do you want daisies in your bedroom or do you want cowboys? I remember fantasizing my way into the little vignettes and wallpapers. You could sit in the kitchen and move from the Pilgrim's, you know, landing to the Thanksgiving dinner. Wallpaper is a very rich medium. It's not just about pattern in a room. It's about either bringing the outdoors in. It's about setting up stories. It can be literally photographic wallpaper. In some ways, it's been considered a second-class citizen. I think it needs to be reconsidered as an art form in its own right.
I've been hearing you're concerned about my happiness. While you and your friends are worrying about me, I'm having lots of fun counting flowers on the wall that don't bother me at all. Playing solitaire.
Susan Yelovich is the author of Contemporary World Interiors and other books. Almost everywhere I glance these days, this new century, the 21st, is looking very much like an old one. the 19th. Let me explain. Back in the 20th century, from World War II until around 1980, almost all serious contemporary painting and architecture and music was abstract, modernist, even harsh sometimes. And what's returned since is the kind of work that was supposedly outlawed by the 20th century. Respectable paintings of recognizable people and things, respectable buildings made from traditional materials in traditional forms, and respectable music that isn't grating and sometimes has melody. And during this same time, old distinctions between ambitious high culture and trivial low culture have been blurred or erased. Tell me, are Philip Glass and Quentin Tarantino and Cirque du Soleil high or low culture? Today's swinging, mix-and-match cultural hodgepodge is generally called postmodern. But to me, it's very much like pre-modern America. Back in the middle of the 19th century, characters, for instance, in popular plays delivered these outrageous self-referential asides to the audience. A single evening at the theater might feature Shakespeare and vaudeville. A concert could encompass music of Chopin and Stephen Foster. And in Lower Manhattan in New York, P.T. Barnum's American Museum had museum displays, but also had freak shows and lectures and a shooting gallery. Same thing in the media. Back in the 19th century, newspapers depended less on advertising than they have recently, and commercial-free media today is now the new big thing. In the 19th century, newspapers were small and quirky and really partisan, like today's blogs, among other things. But our wholesale time travel today back to the 1800s is not all good. When I was in public school in Nebraska in the 1960s and 70s, evolution was not controversial or a theory. Darwin versus Genesis was no more a debate than round Earth versus flat Earth. The thing is, back in the late 20th century, all of these settled questions about art and religion, all these big, fat, conventional wisdoms seemed unassailable, irreversible. That's just the way it was, as Walter Cronkite used to say. And I guess at the zenith of any era, that's always the way it is. I'm Kurt Anderson. You've been listening today to Studio 360, and I hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC, along with PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Arun Roth,
David Krasnow,
Lital Malad,
Michelle Siegel,
Ave Carrillo,
Eric Malinsky,
Brad Titel,
Elizabeth Rich,
John Boyle.
Our theme music was composed by David Van Tegum. Thanks to Jennifer Van Dyke for reading the poem by Emily Dickinson.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Additional support is provided by The Economist, featuring weekly book reviews and global arts coverage on newsstands and on the web at economist.com/books. And by Hofstra University, continuing its Great Writers, Great Reading series, where some of America's most eminent writers read from their own works. More details at hofstra.edu.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You think you're good?
I mean good.
I'm saying, are you, you know, like a good person?
Hey, I'm eating lunch.
Why do we love watching bad people?
Whether you like it or not, it makes good drama. You have to find people that rub each other the wrong way, and I seem to have a knack for it.
The playwright and director Neil LaBute, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.